welcome to Worlds Apart. More than a century ago, Mark Twain remarked that God created war so that Americans would learn geography. My guest today has supported all recent American-led wars and attempts at regime change, but he's absolutely appalled by Russia's actions in Ukraine. Why is that? To discuss that, I'm now joined by former U.S. National Security Advisor and former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton. Ambassador Bolton, it's such a rare treat for a Russian journalist to speak to you. Thank you very much for this occasion.
Well, thank you for having me. Glad to do it.
Now, you have the reputation of being a pretty hawkish thinker, especially when it comes to Russia. When you look at the events in and around Ukraine, whom do you blame first? Is it President Putin or President Biden?
Well, I think this is unquestionably an act of unprovoked aggression by Russia. There's no legitimate explanation for it. So I think the responsibility does lie with President Putin and his government. I think, unfortunately, that the West failed adequately to deter Putin from launching the invasion, and that's a great tragedy. But in this instance, it's pretty clear where the responsibility lies.
Now, President Putin, in his own words, is motivated by defending Russia's strategic interest, so he will definitely disagree with your definition of an unprovoked aggression. But let me establish that first. Do you believe that Russia has any security prerogatives when it comes to its own neighborhood, and especially when it comes to the American and NATO presence in its neighborhood?
Well, it certainly has an interest in its own strategic security. But the fact is, the countries that border on Russia have an interest in their strategic security as well. And it's not just dealing with Eastern and Central European countries that were previously independent. Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania have all joined NATO. They border on Russia. They were part of the Soviet Union by force, not by choice. And by choice, they've decided to join NATO. Finland may soon decide to join NATO, as may Sweden. So, you know, every country gets to determine how its own security plays out. NATO has always been a defensive alliance. Russia has always known that. Mm-hmm.
And every country, I assume you would agree, has also its own choice of the means that it uses to defend its interests. Now, the means that Vladimir Putin chose to defend Russia's interests may seem disproportionate or excessive to some, but I'm sure to you they are pretty conventional, given that you're somebody who supported or advocated for military action in Iran, Iraq, Syria, Libya, Venezuela, Cuba, North Korea, and the list goes on. Are you saying that the use of force that seems to be so permissible to the United States in your own eyes should be absolutely off limits when it comes to other great powers?
Well, obviously, any use of force has to be justified, and certainly acting in self-defense is a legitimate use of force. Nobody questions that. And I think the preemptive use of force against a real threat to the United States or its friends and allies in order to prevent devastation of innocent civilians is also justifiable. So when states like Iran or North Korea seek nuclear weapons, use of force is fully justifiable. When a country commits unprovoked aggression, as Iraq did against Kuwait in 1990, Kuwait is entitled in the exercise of its own self-defense to ask for allies to protect it, which is why we attacked Iraq. So there are a lot of there are a lot of different situations and different facts, different circumstances give rise to different remedies.
Absolutely. But in most of those circumstances, the existential interests of the United States were not involved. Your own populations were not threatened either in Libya or in Syria, or for that matter, during the second Iraqi invasion that you so eagerly supported.
No. That's simply not correct in either case. And you can talk about these others as well. In the case of Syria, where terrorists supported by Iran, supported by the government of Syria, were threatening to create an Islamic state that would have threatened the West as a whole and had very strong Western support across the board with our NATO allies to destroy the Islamic State. Nobody can argue, nobody in their right mind can argue that Ukraine posed any threat to Russia, none whatsoever.
Well, we will talk more about that. That's certainly the case that Russia is trying to advance. And Russia has sounded its deep displeasure with NATO's moving formally and informally towards its borders for quite some time, including when you were in office. You visited Moscow as President Trump's national security advisor. You shook hands with Vladimir Putin. I remember, I think it was in summer of 2018, you even talked about the value of communication between leaders in the most difficult of times. In all fairness, didn't the Kremlin use all the diplomatic means at its disposal to limit the unwelcome and some would say malicious U.S. presence close to Russia's borders?
There's simply no truth to what you're saying. NATO didn't move toward Russia's borders just for the benefit of people in Russia who may not hear this. It was the nations of Eastern and Central Europe, once the Warsaw Pact broke up, after decades of repression by the Soviet Union, that came to NATO and requested membership so that they could create their own free governments and societies, and so that they could have peace and security against external threats. NATO didn't decide it wanted to expand into Eastern Europe. Democratically elected governments expressing the will of their peoples asked for NATO membership,
Mr.
and we
Bolton,
agreed.
Ambassador Bolton, with all due respect, I think you're a shrewd enough thinker to understand that Moscow would find it quite provocative that the United States was arming, providing Ukraine with lethal weapons for a pretty long period of time. You may disagree that it poses a threat to Moscow, but Moscow is within its own right to determine what seems as threatening. And it did signal its displeasure with it, didn't it?
So you believe Moscow would be perfectly within its rights to attack Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania right now?
Absolutely not, because I don't think Latvia, Estonia are big enough countries to pose a security threat to Russia. Ukraine, a very large European country, would be. And given that President Zelensky recently raised a specter of a nuclear confrontation, of re-establishing its nuclear expertise, you think the Russians should have missed that comment at the Munich Security Conference?
So let me get your rationale here. If a country is big enough, like Ukraine, then Russia is entitled to invade. How about
not
Poland?
Entitled? Then Russia should take its security interests seriously, and I think it did communicate that to the Americans. You cannot deny that.
Nobody denies that Russia has legitimate security interests, but that doesn't mean you have
a license. Okay, and what are they? Can I ask you, what are those legitimate security interests? Can you define them? For example, in terms of the flight time that it takes for the rockets to reach Moscow, how would you define that security interest? What would be the comfortable flight time for you for rockets to reach Russia?
Well, I don't know. Russian rockets can reach the United States in 30 minutes. That's not very comfortable either. The point is that the question of what constitutes a legitimate threat to Russian security is a subject Russia has to prove. And there's absolutely no evidence that Ukraine has ever had the capacity to threaten Russia.
Well, I think Russia is proving that right now on the battlefield. But rather than arguing about that, because we could never agree, let's face it.
I think what Russia is proving on the battlefield is the incompetence of its military and intelligence services.
We will definitely also talk about the tactics of the Russian military. But before we do that, I want to ask you something about the decisions of the Biden administration, because you said recently that it was a strategic mistake by Biden to state that NATO would never interfere with Russia's actions in Ukraine. What about America's presence in Ukraine? I mean, armaments, security advisors, and those empty promises to Ukraine, to Kyiv, with regards to its membership prospects, especially when we consider, you know, a very limited desire on the part of the West to come to Ukraine's defenses. Do you think it was erroneous to make Ukraine believe that the West would come to its support?
Well, I think that that NATO made a significant mistake in 2008 when it rejected President George W. Bush's proposal to put Ukraine and Georgia on a fast track toward NATO membership. And I think President Putin saw that mistake and 4 months later invaded Georgia. Now, the fact is that neither the United States nor NATO responded effectively to that act of unprovoked aggression. And in 2014, President Putin struck again and invaded Ukraine. And once again, neither the United States nor NATO took effective action in response to that unprovoked aggression. But the fact that that these mistakes were made doesn't justify Russia taking another act of unprovoked aggression. What it says is that only when Russia is deterred adequately does it not act with military force. And that's why in this case, making sure that Russia doesn't benefit from this act of aggression is very important.
You mentioned that it was a mistake not to grant Ukraine and Georgia formal membership, but as it is viewed from the Kremlin, it doesn't really matter whether the membership is formal or informal. The fact of arming Ukraine, which the West has been doing very eagerly over the last couple of months and years, already constitutes security threat for Moscow, at least in the Kremlin's calculus. And I want to ask you something as a strategist
This is purely a pretext on the Kremlin's part. What Ukraine was looking to do was make sure that it had adequate defensive capabilities.
Does it have those adequate defense capabilities right now? Did that premise work out well? Does it have it now?
Well, it's doing a lot better than the Kremlin expected, that's for sure.
Well, that's not good enough. But let me ask you again.
Would you like Ukrainian troops marching into Russia, which, you know, if the Russian forces continue to perform as poorly as they have so far?
Mr. Bolton, I would like to for us to be grounded in reality. You know, realpolitik matters something in this world. And I do want...
Russia's losing this war at this point. Russia has failed to achieve its objectives. We don't know exactly what Russia's casualties are, but I think there are going to be a lot of families in Russia missing their sons this coming year.
Now, Ambassador Bolton, let me ask you something as a strategist rather than an ideologue. Whatever you think of Putin, I'm sure authorizing an operation like this was a huge moral and historical dilemma for him because Russia indeed has a very special connection to Ukraine. I wonder if the boldness or the brazenness with which the West was militarizing Ukraine of late was in fact premised on the calculation that Russia would never, ever use force against Ukraine.
No, what you have in Ukraine is a government freely elected by its people, which you do not have in Russia. And the freely elected government in Ukraine looked for defensive capabilities, having seen what Russian arms achieved in 2014, seizing the Crimea, seizing territory in the Donbass. They wanted the ability to withstand that, to deter future Russian aggression. Now, anybody who believes that the quantity and quality of military assistance being provided to Ukraine gave them anything more than an enhanced defensive capability doesn't understand what was going on. It's simply incredible to argue that somehow a buttressed Ukrainian defensive capability was a threat to Russia. It absolutely was not. And I don't even think Vladimir Putin believes that. I think what he thinks he's doing is making good on what he said in 2005 about reversing the breakup of the Soviet Union. That was a hard thing for Russia, but history is a hard teacher. And failing to understand that that was basically an irrevocable breakup is what's causing this tragedy today.
Well, Ambassador Bolton, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Is your media a reflection of reality? In a world transformed, what will make you feel safer? Isolation or community? Are you going the right way or are you being led somewhere? Which direction? What is truth? What is fake? In a world corrupted, you need to descend. So join us in the depths or remain in the shallows.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton. Ambassador Bolton, you mentioned that in Putin's mind, and Americans, for some reason, love so much to read Putin's mind. So I will rely on your capacity to do that because we, the Russians, don't always succeed in that. Do you think the Ukrainian state will continue to exist after Russia fulfills its objectives in Ukraine, its military objectives?
Well, we don't know what the military objectives are, but I think the Ukrainian state can certainly exist in exile, even in the worst of circumstances, as governments did in World War II after the Nazi occupation. And I think that's something that that Putin and his advisors should have considered before they began this operation. But I don't see how, at this point, the Russian military can really expect to take control of the entire country. I think that's beyond their grasp.
And maybe that's also beyond their aspiration, because the Kremlin has never pronounced that to be its objectives. All it said...
It hasn't said what its objectives are, but it's attacked the capital city.
No. It did say that the objective number one was demilitarization and taking out Ukraine's military infrastructure. And the second objective was what he called denazification, that is the elimination of far-right militia groups in Ukraine. But let's talk about
total pretext, as we know. Those were made up objectives.
Of course, you know the best. I mean, Mr. Bolton, you know, how many times did the United States attack foreign lands on false pretexts? Innumerable times, but yet...
Zero times, as far as I know.
Of course, especially the second invasion of Iraq. Yeah, the chemical weapons, and we all remember that. But anyway, you said that the Russian military effort is now bogged down to the surprise of many Western analysts. And I wonder if this surprise of Western analysts rose out of the very different ways in which the Russians and the Americans fight their wars, the Russians relying far more on the manpower and the Americans relying far more on the heavy artillery.
Well, let's go back to Iraq's chemical weapons. You know who also believed that Iraq had chemical weapons? The United Nations, because Iraq itself had declared those chemical weapons after the first Gulf War and showed them.
You are hiding behind the facade of the United Nations. That was never a strong point in your career. You were never a big fan of that organization.
I thought it might be impressive to you. The issue now is not the different styles of warfare that the countries engage in, although the Russian style is going to cost it in casualties, sadly for Russia, going forward and the families that will suffer as a result from it, it's whether completely unprovoked aggression is acceptable. And the answer is that it's not. So this is something that that Russia is going to pay a heavy price for. Mm-hmm. The tragedy, though, I think, is that the U.S. failed to deter it to begin with. But mm-hmm. that's not going to lessen the price for Russia.
Mm-hmm. I actually agree with you that the Russians are taking upon themselves a risk of higher military casualties precisely because they have an objective of limiting civilian death toll. And there is a very understandable tactical...
They're certainly not doing a very good job of that.
They're actually doing that a pretty good job. And if you compare the casualties in the first few weeks of, let's say, the Iraqi offensive and the Ukrainian offensive, it's incomparable. You cannot even compare that.
That's true. That's true. There are substantially greater civilian casualties in Ukraine.
No, you're actually lying. Right. You are lying here because according to the UN, in the 4 weeks of the Ukrainian campaign, around 800 people were killed. If we compare that to the first 6 weeks of the shock and awe operation, it was around 7,400 civilians killed. Those are official figures. And we are not even talking about how those official figures were achieved. But coming back to the issue of different styles of offensives, the Russians having to rely much more on the manpower and the Americans having to rely much more on the heavy artillery and essentially bombing the cities and only then moving in, can't you at least give Russians the credit for trying to protect civilians? Because I know we are adversaries, but, you know, at least in the Russian culture, there is a tradition of respecting the, you know, noble acts of the adversaries. Can you be a little bit more straightforward here?
Well, I'd respect noble acts if I saw any. The fact is the approach that Russia is using here, very familiar to President Putin, what he did in Chechnya, in the Second Chechenian War and during the Yeltsin term, what he has been doing in Syria. And really, it is a style of warfare that I think is shocking to the rest of the world. It may be unusual. It may be because it's in Europe rather than in Chechnya or Syria. It shouldn't be that different. But in fact, I think people understand this is a very brutal form of warfare, and it's not going to achieve Russia's objectives, to say the least.
Any form of warfare is brutal, but it's much more careful of the civilian casualties than the American style. And since you mentioned Syria,
we actually call that style the Swiss cheese style,
because in Syria, if you remember, if you looked at the map of Syria during that offensive, there were lots of opposition-held enclaves located right next to the government-controlled areas, precisely because of Russia's refusal to use heavy artillery on heavily populated areas. That is very different from the way the Americans fought that war, and the Russians brought a totally new style of warfare to the Middle East, which the Middle East actually appreciates, believe it or not.
Yeah, well, we could take a vote of that throughout the Middle East. I mean, I think Russia in some cases was content to rely on a Syrian ally to attack the civilian targets the Russians gave them intelligence about.
We were talking before about the Syria and how the how Syria posed a threat to the United States because it was a seed of Islamic terrorism. Now, there is a credible concern, not only in Russia, but also around the world, about the rise of far-right battalions in Ukraine. Ukraine that, according to America's own experts, has been used as a training ground for far-right militia from around the world. And, you know, the forces that President Zelensky, despite his 3 years in office, not being able to control. Is that a legitimate threat as far as you're concerned?
Well, American legislation forbids any assistance that we give to Ukraine going into any terrorist hands, right, left, or anywhere else. And those don't become acceptable simply because they happen to be on the Ukrainian side of the border. But none of that excuses the aggression that Russia has committed and continues to commit. These, again, are pretexts that are coming after the decision was made that Putin wanted to establish Russian hegemony over Ukraine through the use of force.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned that it's pretexts that only appeared after the launch of this offensive, and I want to give you some figures from the Time magazine article last year, which cited that 17,000 foreign fighters have come to Ukraine over the last 6 years from over 50 countries. Some of them were associated with terrorist attacks in the West, including the one in Christchurch, New Zealand, where 51 people were killed. If that were happening close to your border, would you be okay with that?
Well, if I thought it were true, it would be a concern. But if you have this information and can verify it, then I think you need to present it and people can make up their own minds. But even if everything you've just said is true, it has absolutely nothing to do with Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
Well, how is it not, how does it have anything to do with Russia's invasion in Ukraine? Because if you actually look at what's happening on the ground, the most notorious clashes, the fiercest clashes that occur there are not between the Russian and Ukrainian military forces. They are between the Russian troops and the far-right military battalions. You know,
and it's... Just for my information, where did these supposed clashes take place with
Mariupol.
These...
Around Mariupol. Are you familiar with this town? I think there are around 130,000 civilians that are being still held hostage there, not being let out despite the existence of humanitarian corridors both to Russia and to mainland Ukraine. Have you ever heard about that town, Mariupol, and the Azov battalion that took a seat there?
This is the only newscast of which I'm aware that says that that the people fighting there for Ukraine are right-wing terrorists. And I think that's something you really need to consider. Everything we see and independent Western press observers believe that this is the Ukrainian army making a very heroic stand against overwhelming force has nothing to do with right-wing terrorists.
Now, let's talk about how this may end. You advocated for the harshest possible sanctions against Russia, a Ronald Reagan type of response, which would combine a firm stance and support for Russia's opposition. What can possibly be achieved through that?
Well, I think this is really up to the Russian people now. I don't know that anything will necessarily take place during the course of the war, but I think a lot of Russians are voting with their feet, leaving the country, and expressing their concerns. We've seen some real acts of bravery inside Russia, and at one point we could find out what Russians really think if they'd actually have a free and fair election.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you one more question about the reaction of China? Because many analysts, both in the East and in the West, agree that China's position would be crucial in determining how much pain Russia suffers in the face of Western sanctions. And it's evident from the latest call between President Biden. You wish. I'm sure you were President Bolton. But the recent call between President Biden and President Xi, that it seems that the U.S. main means of dissuasion now are threats, sticks, rather than carrots or any form of positive reinforcement. Do you think Beijing will find it appealing or threatening enough to comply with Washington?
Well, I think China is a threat in and of itself to the United States and the West as a whole. And the question of how to deal with China is going to be a huge subject of debate. I don't know whether these telephone calls from President Biden will dissuade China or not, but I think China is going to need to think about this, because if they have designs on free places like Taiwan and others in the Indo-Pacific, they need to recognize that there's a stronger and stronger view in the United States. We will not accept this.
Well, there may be a stronger and stronger view, but the tools in your toolbox seem to be rather limited. In fact, I've heard a number of analysts suggest that the most opportune time for Beijing to assume full control of Taiwan would arise right after the end of the Russian operation in Ukraine, because the American ability to hit Beijing with sanctions would be at its minimum. Do you think that will come to pass?
Well, I think China would be making a huge mistake if they drew that conclusion, that's for sure. And in terms of the policy of the United States, if you think it's tough under Joe Biden, wait until we get an administration that whose views are closer to mine.
Well, God help us at that time, Ambassador Bolton. But we have to leave it here at this point. When you come to office, I will request that interview again. But for the time being, thank you very much for your perspective.
Glad to give it.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again next week on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.